5.
Warning. This podcast contains language which may be offensive to some people. You have been warned.
Whatever.
In 1979, a little boy was born. It was this little boy that would change the world forever. With courage and luck by his side, he set off across hills and mountains to find his destiny. Paul Spivey.
Yeah! Hello and welcome to the show, Spivercast 15. Now this week, I have something absolutely huge to play you. It's an interview, and I was so happy to grab their attention and they were going to come on the show. But first, I need to tell you how you can follow me on Twitter. It's at the Spivercast. At the Spivercast. You can follow me there. I will follow you straight back. And now we're also on Mixcloud, mixcloud.com/thespivercast. And that is where you'll hear each and every one of these shows. Because like what I've always said, it's a real shame when I upload these to Dropbox and send them straight across to Facebook. And it's a real shame because after a few days, it disappears and the link just crashes. So that is where you'll find it, mixcloud.com/thespivercast. We're also on YouTube as well, type in the Spivercast. I can't believe how many people have viewed Spivercast 12. Now, I said to Sam, there must be something I've done or said in that show to make everyone like it or listen to. Spivercast 11 isn't really listened to as much. Neither is Spivercast 10. So I have no idea whatsoever why people keep liking Spivercast 12. So, just over a week ago, I managed to chat to Greg Rodman and Andy Mason, two of the most talented young individuals I've probably ever met. They are the makers of the film Project Left to Survive. It's a great film. You need to see it. If you haven't seen this film, Project Left to Survive, you need to see it. It's free. It doesn't cost a penny to watch. It's free on YouTube. And it speaks for itself. If you're into that sort of film, which I wasn't first of all, but then when Alex Buchter, the co-producer of the Spivercast, posted the link on my Facebook, I'd watched it, and I was really amazed on how they managed to take filming to the next level. And it's a real dark film, and I don't mean dark as in I think what I'm trying to say, it's very dark. I can't think of any other words to say to explain the film, but you need to see this film. It's free, it doesn't cost a penny. Project Left to Survive on YouTube, and this interview explains how they made it, what they did, and they answered most of my questions, which is great, because I'm not really the sort of person that is great at interviewing. I'm pretty naff. But anyway, I'm gonna stop talking now, because I'm talking shite. So this is the interview. It took me quite some time to make this interview and edit it all together. So if you're one of these cats that puts horrible comments on my YouTube and I have to delete them, I know where you live, right? So this is the interview. I'm going to stop talking now. I hope you enjoy. It's had 2,000 views on YouTube. Check it out.
My name is John K. Mason, and I am a survivor of the 2013 Umbrella Corporation outbreak. We'd all been through so much making our way to the safe house on that day 6 months ago. And now, 6 months on from those events, the planet has become a wasteland dominated by the Walking Dead. If you're listening to this, my notes, records, and a copy of the antivirus can be found at the coordinates enclosed. Wherever you are, whatever danger you face, I wish you luck. because in this new world, there are few of us left. Left to love, left to fight, left to survive.
The reason why I sort of made this film was because I don't feel that Hollywood are quite doing justice to that kind of genre at the moment. So it's all about money, it's not really about like fans that actually, I guess, kind of brought the genre into the limelight in the first place. You know, it's all very plastic, the characters don't have as much depth, anything like that. So really, like, with this film, it was about, yeah, just trying to capture that, and it was about capturing as many of those moments in films where you get the shiver up your spine. And so that's why it's more about like just sequences of action and less kind of I guess background stuff, because I just wanted every scene to have that moment in it where you go, that's kick-ass, you know. Yeah, like you, yeah, just sort of, it, for example, you know, when they're in the mall, when he comes out with the bigger gun, or like when you see the first helicopter, and then mixing that in with obviously the audio and the timing is crucial for that kind of bit. But I wanted to get as many of those moments in it as possible.
I was going to ask, how long did a film like this take to perfect and complete from start? So you sat down at the desk and you're writing it all. How long did it take from start to finish?
I approached Andy back in March 2013.
Yeah, that would be March 2013.
Yeah, so we all sat around the table and said, originally the film was meant to be a short, so it was meant to be about half an hour, but then it kind of got longer and longer, and it took us 13 months start to finish.
13 months?
Yeah.
That's pretty good going.
Yeah, it's not too bad. But like I said, it started off as a small project, and then you kind of had to adapt to sort of make sure that there was enough character development, and there were certain things that, you know, needed to be in it in order for it to make sense, and we all kind of adapted it from there, yeah.
One of the main things that really cooked, I loved it all, but there was one thing that really stood out for me was when you all got into the back of the pickup and the rain was coming and the mood was set. It was perfect. Is that something it was just happened, or did you wait for that minute?
I know how I felt about that. See, I don't know how you felt, Andy, about that. See,
yeah, I remember you putting up the picture, didn't you, in regards to the gaming that night on Facebook. Heavy rain, you said. So yeah, it was tough to film in, but I think it added a lot to it. It just happened to be there at the time, and actually, it's worked out very, very well. I think that scene and the music that was selected for it, it was excellent. Actually, very,
yeah,
very.
The that was actually one of the last group scenes we shot. And we were forced to, because of times. I mean, none of the actors in the film are professional actors. Nobody's got any training. Nobody got paid. And everybody has full-time jobs. So it's very hard to work a schedule around that. And so we were kind of like, right, in the next month, you know, when is everybody free? And it had to be then. So really, for that scene, the truck was hired. So we had to just do it, come rain or shine.
That scene had to be there because it serviced the story. Because there had to be an explanation, because we know that they were arranged to meet him at the truck at 2200 hours, and yeah, they did.
Yeah, in the rain.
So everything worked out perfectly. There was a lovely crystal clear blue design to the film itself. It was so good. What was that called? What was that?
So I shot everything on a 550, Canon 550 with a prime lens, 50mm prime lens, which gives that nice soft effect, so you get out of focus background and focus in shot. And then you basically grade the entire thing. So you colourise different scenes depending on lighting, shading, things like that, to try and get everything consistent. And the first film I can remember that really shone out for me was The Matrix. And it has that kind of grainy green throughout the whole thing. And it just elevates a film from looking like someone's done it in their back garden to something that's sort of semi.
The listeners who haven't seen it, can you summarise the film in your own words?
Do you want to summarise it?
something that I think that there's a lot there for people who are gaming fans in particular, people who are fans of horror genre, sort of stuff like Wes Craven, that sort of stuff, I think. There's action, but there's also a story there as well that's being told, and I think that's quite important to point out. It's not just, you know, you're in there 5 seconds later, they've landed in amongst a pile of zombies and there's guns a-blazing. There is still a story there that's being told as well. I think that's important to sort of to point
out. Yeah, it's definitely, from my point of view, fans of things like Resident Evil, Silent Hill, but fans of the video game genre rather than the film genre. I mean, the first Silent Hill film actually was, in my eyes, okay, the story and the acting was a bit shocking, but, you know, it still was true to the game, which is probably my favourite one out of the Hollywood kind of take on it. But yeah, it's definitely people who like survival horror games, but retro survival horror. And yeah, it's got good action, local people as well, because we obviously go to a lot of locations locally, so it's nice to sort of say, oh, hang on, that's Woodley Precinct.
About to say, I'm so sad. It's like, oh, look, that's when there's time at the train station.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
How did you manage to film on locations like that? Did you have to get permission, or did you just saw your minute and, right, I'm going to film it, let's do it now?
The end battle sequence, we actually prompted the police in advance, saying what we were going to do and where we were going to be. Saying that we were going to be using air rifles, they said that was fine. We actually also created signs for dog walkers on the day to notify them what we were doing.
Got a few funny looks,
but thankfully everybody just went around us. The only issue we actually had was with the herd of cows and the downpour during filming that scene.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
I saw one of the scenes. You pulled out a massive machine gun. I don't know what it was. I was like, "Whoa!" You know, how did you have to prompt the police for that?
That particular scene was shot in the mall. That was our sort of inside anyway. So we were fortunately we were okay with that. But they were made aware on the day of any other things that we were doing in the field with the slightly smaller guns. So
yeah, the gun. I work for a company in Reading called Z Events, and they run what we claim to be is the UK's best zombie immersive experience, and it's in the old Friar Street Mall in Reading.
Yeah, Alex, because he co-produces this podcast with me, and he got me in contact with you guys.
Yeah,
and he said, ask him about this. And I went, is it something you own or is it something you run?
No, so Z Events is a UK company, they're run by a guy called Lee Fields. He set up the company a few years back. Customers come and they pay a fee to basically take part in a 4-hour immersive story where they're taken around an abandoned shopping mall, which happens to be the one in Friar Street Mall. And there's sort of about 20 or so actors and extras that play police officers and zombies, and they take you around an immersive story with ballistic rated shotguns. So it sort of plays out like that, and I work there as one of the actors on shifts, and so that's where we got the it's actually an airsoft gun, and they use it as an airsoft sight as well. But that's where the big gun came from.
I thought the special effects on the guns were amazing. How did you manage to make it, instead of, like, you know, when you see these films sometimes and you think, oh, you know, and you have to pretend in your mind that it's firing, but I could actually see the fire at the end of the gun. How did you manage that? How did that?
All of the guns are done in post-production, all of the effects on the guns. So I actually worked with a guy called Jim McMorrow. He's up in Bicester. He's a special effects guy, and he was kind enough to do the effects for free. And basically, it's just about tracking, like, the end of the gun, and then you composite the muzzle flash over the top. And I'm pretty sure it's like a technique that's been used, like, through Hollywood for years and years and years, because guns don't actually make a muzzle flash when they go off. So they would go off in films, and as they go off, no one would know they'd gone off. So Hollywood actually added the muzzle flash to the end of the gun to make sure that the viewer knew that the gun had gone off, and we're technically using the same technique to do that. Having said that, in the first film, we've got very shaky guns, So, right. Like, trying to pretend that the gun's gone off, you know, we're shaking the guns. And I think, like, definitely Chris, who plays Sarge in the film, he studied sort of gun recoil and stuff like that to make sure that in this film we all got our recoils fairly good, which helps to the, obviously, the illusion that it's going off.
The planet has become a wasteland, dominated by the walking dead. No longer are you able to walk down the street or take a trip to the mall without the sound of a crying, mutilated girl, suffocated by her need for stinking human flesh. The obvious question I found asking is, are these cannibals? My resounding answer is no. Cannibalism, in the true sense of the word, implies an interspecies activity. These things cannot be considered human. They prey on humans. They do not prey on each other. This is the obvious difference. They hunt in packs, each taking on a predator-like responsibility, distracting with noise and confusion until they have their victims surrounded.
I have to ask about the makeup on the zombies. Even up close, when I look at the scenes, you can't even tell that it's makeup. How long did that take to apply on each person?
That field scene on that morning, we had about three or four different people doing sort of just base coats initially, and then, you know, there's a couple of, it must have been about over a dozen or so sort of just standard zombies. They must have been up at like, I don't know, it must have been about 6 o'clock in the morning or something. I think they initially started, and we weren't done, that we weren't even up at the field until maybe 10, 11 o'clock, I think.
Yeah, really.
So there was a lot of work to be done. I mean, it's absolutely stunning. I mean, the jump that we've made, I mean, it was incredible what Annalise was able to do with the spitter work, and Delrith as well. That was specifically made for the film.
Yeah, so Subject 12 had a full headmaster.
Yes,
made.
Yeah.
So he did really well, because he had to have that on the entire day. It was a warm day.
It did look very hot in the day.
Yeah, so he did really well. But yeah, Annalise, she's the exec producer on the project, and she's also lead makeup, so she did most of the makeup, so all credit to her, really.
When on filming, because one of the scenes as well, there was a person changing in the middle of the road, and there was an abandoned car, and it had its hazard lights on.
That might have been the first film.
I think it was.
Yeah, so the hunter scene, there's a car on the right hand side, black.
That's
car.
It. Yeah. Did you have to shut off roads to film, or did you just see the moment?
That was actually shot 2 years ago in June of 2012. So that was the Jubilee weekend. And what we'd done over that long weekend is got up at, like, I think even earlier, I think it was like 3 o'clock in the morning. That is, it can be relatively busy, that road, because it's actually where there's a sort of a fleet of shops. But because it was so early in the morning, thankfully, there was no one around. That was really the only way I suppose we were going to do it. I don't know.
We even winged that. I don't even think I'd planned to shoot there. We were just sort of walking towards Dinton Pastures, and I said, oh yeah, let's just shoot it here, and then that car's mine. So I thought, let's just skew it on the side and stick the hazards on, and that, you know, had a bit of the effect that you can hide behind. Yeah, you'd be surprised how much of this project was just winged.
Yeah, no, it's, do you actually walk down places and think, right, we'll film there?
Yeah, sometimes you'll recce a place, yeah. So you'll, I definitely knew, like, for the first one, I wanted to shoot over at Showcase Cinemas in the underpass. I definitely knew I wanted to shoot there. Sometimes you, yeah, I mean, the way you sort of picture out scenes, you need to go and work out how you see it, but yeah, for the first film, half of it was winged. Second film, not so much.
Did you get many people that, because there's always one person that doesn't want you to film there, you know, you're not filming on my land. Did you ever get any, like, parked cars naughtily parked there just deliberately? Did you ever get a bit of that? Or
I think someone's next door neighbour, I think, might have.
The only one I can think of is when we were shooting the truck on the same night as we shot the truck in the rain scene. There was an old car park with some old fence, and it looked really run down. It was really perfect. It's actually, there's a bit in the film where Lewis, played by Hansi Linowitz, he walks past a fence that's falling apart. in his white shirt.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then he gets into the truck. That bit there, we were actually told on the night, a guy came along and said, this is private property. You know, you're not meant to be here. I mean, there was nothing around. It was just dead space. But yeah, he's obviously doing his job. I think that was the only time where we sort of said, okay, well, we'll have to pack up and try plan B.
The stately home, or the when we went to go to the scene where I actually go and find the herbs.
Yeah.
That, I mean, you'd already rung in advance, or because when we went there, it was so eerie, that place as well. I had a great atmosphere before we'd even started filming, because we never actually saw, we saw one person, I think, in the car park, mm-hmm. and he passed us by, but we never saw anybody at all in any of the house. We saw the lights were on, then they all went off. Then the doors and the back doors and everything were all open. It was really eerie, because there was absolutely no one around, and it did actually sort of add to the effect.
Yeah, it was
of,
a great
the
location.
Whole,
yeah.
It was.
I wanted a mansion in the film, obviously, for Resident Evil.
Yeah.
The first one, so I wanted to just pay homage to that, and I knew about this place, and I'd been to ask him if we could shoot there, and he said unofficially, yes, you can. So I took that as yes.
Yeah.
And so we did it, and we just shot that short sequence of Andy walking down.
One of my favourite zombies was the spitter. I thought it was a brilliant idea. It was so good that where I was locked into the film so much that a cat sat behind me, and it's what the, but you know, it's where I was clued onto it. But the spitter was one of my favourites on there, and I liked it because once the spit had been spat, it paralysed her for a certain period of time.
Subject 01, mutation code reference, spitter. Commonly female, only mentioned briefly in the file notes, she possesses the ability to spit a ball of acid from long distances, which, upon hitting the ground, will expand and damage any civilians who make contact with it. After spitting, the spitter is temporarily paralyzed, giving you a chance to kill her. She is, however, one of the most powerfully infected if civilians are caught standing in her spit and are too distracted to move quickly due to other infected or lack of awareness at damage being dealt.
Is that something you thought of, or is it something you borrowed from somewhere? Or
that is paying homage to Left 4 Dead, the spitter character from Left 4 Dead 2. Actually, I suppose that was good storytelling actually at the start, because it was explained, talking about the file notes of that particular character, and then there's sort of the person then, or the person watching it then, sort of knows later on, I can see that's the spitter, and then it sort of slows or stops moving after it's spat, and then that's why it's sort of like sort of prone to maybe being attacked itself after it's made the initial attack itself on its victims.
There are several characters that are inspired by Left 4 Dead, because the first film was a Left 4 Dead parody almost perfectly. And this film then just pays homage to that, as well as some other survival horror games that I just wanted to get in there. But the Chargers from Left 4 Dead, the guy that runs and picks people up, and there's like hunters in there and boomers in there, and they're all from Left 4 Dead.
And the witch as well from the first movie, who has and there's another witch cameo as well in this movie.
Yeah.
Subject 03X, mutation code reference, Charger. Its main attack, most frequently found to be unexpected, is charging forward and ploughing into unaware civilians. On a successful charge, he will grab and carry a single victim whilst knocking down the others. Once the charger has hit a wall, or after he has run a certain distance, he will begin slamming his captive into the ground until restrained. The charger appears to have a rocky or callous surface on his larger right arm, which may be what he uses to inflict most of his force when charging.
The zombies are so good acting, you know, so good. How did you pick the right people for the to be in it?
We had a couple of people from Zed Events, and I know that one of the people, she's in several of the scenes in the end battle, and you can see how good and why we used her so much, because she was so good at what she does. There's so many good shots with her.
Yeah, Tash Robinson is the girl from Zed Events. We also had Emma, she's from Zed, but working every weekend as a zombie, you get to perfect the technique. But to be honest, we were lucky with it, because everybody, when you approach them and you say, oh yeah, you know, we're making this film, they're like, yeah, 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 we want to be in it, yeah, we'll be a zombie, yeah, we'll come down. And then when you say, well, you've got to be there at 5, you've got to spend 2 hours in makeup, you've got to run around in the field all day, and then you don't go home until 7, there's a lot of standing around waiting. You know, they then sort of like, oh, I'm a bit busy.
They don't want to do it then,
yeah,
do they?
So, you know, luckily, like, in an ideal world, we would have had, like, twice as many as we'd had. So we just were lucky that we got who we did, really.
Obviously, every film has a stand down, be it where there was something happening or something. What do you all do when it's just standing down, when you're waiting?
I'm never waiting around.
I'm singing here. Disney songs in the background, putting people off. Yeah. So, which
Frozen.
Is it a bit of Frozen?
It was a lot of Lion King, and I think of a bit of Aladdin as well.
Yeah, no. That wasn't distracting at all.
So the film, in a whole, it runs really, really well. There's no time for it to pause, a little bit of chatting, because when you see films, they have a bit of romance, and you're like, oh, come on, really? But the film flew really, really well. Did you plan to do that from the start, or is it something that just worked out that way?
You know what, I think, like, I completely agree. I'm getting a bit bored of these 2.5 hour films that just waste time telling us the same love story. And it's not that I don't think it's important, it's just trying to tell it in a more immersive way. We went to The Amazing Spider-Man 2 recently. Thought some of the action sequences and some of the storytelling was amazing, but it basically just tells the same story that we've seen over and over again. So and I'm sat there in those moments and I'm thinking, why is this in, you know, just cut it down, make it a bit shorter, we've seen it all before. So in this film I didn't want to ignore that, because I still wanted there to be a little bit of a connection between Subject 17, Veronica's character, and Sarge's character. So that you'll always see in the film that they're kind of always paired off, especially in the end sequence. He's very much kind of keeping an eye on her, and that kind of would work. It's because it started off short and then got bigger, and then, to be honest with you, it didn't really have time for me to pad it out. It didn't need that padding, so you end up with just lots of stuff that holds your attention.
Was there a lot of parts of the film where you didn't plan to do in the original writing of it all, and things that you thought, well, this would look slightly better, and not using that? Did you chop and change it, or is it stuck to the script as was?
No, it's absolutely a sort of progressive process of, yeah, I mean, you have the basic idea of a start, middle and end, and then really as you're just going through it, the creative process just kind of takes over, and you just think, this works really well, that doesn't work, and you just tweak as you go along. And I think we were recording the final script and I was tweaking the final voiceover script right up until the week before the premiere.
Tuesday, I think it was, and the premiere was on the Saturday, so it was 5 days.
Yeah, so I mean, it was definitely a progressive.
One of the things, you use a helicopter in there, and I was actually really surprised. I thought perhaps you'd get in it and then it would flip to something, but it actually flies away.
We're heading to the abandoned Willamette Parkview Mall in the centre of the city. I believe he's being held on the main level outside an establishment called Peacock's. I suggest we head to the west side. Not only this will allow us enough room for an airdrop, but it's also the quickest and safest route into the building. I'll meet you with the truck at the south side exit at 2200 hours without fail. I know you've got this, but watch your back. Subject 12 isn't going to make this easy. Bring you back in one piece. I know he can be difficult at times, but he's one of us, and we're going to need him. Buckle up, and let's repay the favour.
I have to ask, is it yours?
I wish it was.
No, unfortunately not. That was a scene that we'd actually arranged to do on a couple of occasions, but we were let down, unfortunately, by the weather. But it was actually shot in two different scenes. One with us, of course, getting into the chopper, and then another scene where the chopper flies away, which is actually filmed on a different day.
Yeah, I'll give you a little exclusive. The chopper that takes off is not the same chopper that they get into.
Oh, right. All right, I was thinking about that.
Same place, but they're both Jet Ranger copters, but due to kind of, again, us all having a working schedule and trying to fit it in with the helicopter guys, I had to go midweek and film the helicopter taking off, and it's double the size. And then we luckily, like 2 weeks before, I think, managed to get down there on a Saturday morning with everybody and film all of the scenes inside and them getting into it and then taking off. But yeah,
I see that zombies have overtaken vampires. There was a little bit where people love vampires, but zombies now have just increased, and there's so many followers of zombies now. Where do you see zombies in the future?
I'm not sure. What do you think?
Still think it seems to have been picked up, hasn't it? I'm not sure what the original catalyst for was, unless it was actually things like Left 4 Dead or the gaming.
Or the most recent.
Sort of like, because I mean, we had it in the 80s, didn't we? A lot of those kind of, I suppose it's like more sort of B-rate, like the Return of the Living Dead sort of films, wasn't it? Well, and it seemed to die. I didn't see it so much in the 90s. But it seems to be the younger generation seem to be very, very keen on everything zombie this last sort of 5 years or so.
It's difficult because there's only so far you can really go with it, and I think most of it's already been done. So then it really just comes down to character development and how you fit them into a concept. Like, you know, you've got films where, you know, there's thousands of zombies, and then you've got films where it's just more about an infection. And yeah, there's not really many ways you could take it. So then it's just about how you interpret that kind of genre, I guess.
With said offence, now, for me personally, if you stuck me in a warehouse, a dark warehouse, I would actually lay eggs. I couldn't do it. What sort of person goes to these events? Now, I don't mean that in any diss whatsoever, but you'd have to be some sort of real good character to want to be scared at that level, really.
Well, we actually did it in 2012, like a couple of months after it first started. We went along as customers. I definitely did it because I'm a fan of the survival horror games. So it basically puts you in a fantasy of, you know, I'm in a real life zombie apocalypse and I get to shoot zombies, and, you know, you get to play out the characters.
But like being part of a bit like a Left 4 Dead, like as opposed to sort of like playing the game, I was sort of in the game, so to speak. So
yeah, now that's definitely what attracted me to it. But people like being scared, you know.
I know, it's crazy.
It's adrenaline, you know, the adrenaline.
Fight or flight sort of thing that we don't have anymore or in the natural world. But yeah, you still want to sort of get. It's like, I suppose, as if some people get it from like doing something like abseiling, or maybe they'll do something like a roller coaster. But in this case, it's sort of getting, you know, sort of jumped or chased around. Chase around a shopping mall.
So, yeah, it's absolutely that roller coaster feeling. You know, it's that scared. You're scared, but you want to go on it. It's overcoming fear. You know, it's that sense of achievement. It's wanting to be a hero. You know, there are chances to be heroes. You know, it's that kind of thing, I think.
Was it you that was smoking the cigars in the?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so
do you smoke? do you smoke cigars? Because it loads of cigars. I can't do it. And action, I can't. I haven't finished yet.
No, I like the occasional cigar every now and again. I wouldn't say they're too expensive, to be honest. Yeah,
no.
The cigars in the film I got from, I was saying to Andy before he came over, we got them from the Caribbean because I was over there on holiday and I just thought, oh, I'll get some for film because it's like 4 for £10, whereas they're about £20 each if you get them in this
country. So if people want to be involved with this, the Z Defence and you as a whole, how would they contact you? Are you on Facebook, or are you on Twitter, or is there a website?
Yeah, so the best place is probably Facebook at the moment. So we've got a Facebook page for anyone that likes the film, and all of the, you get sort of cast photos on there. We're about to run a competition to give away a signed poster by all the cast and crew. And yeah, just fire us a message on there if you're interested, or if you feel that you can add to the next project that we've got on. That's probably the best place to do it. We are on Twitter. We don't really have an email address, but yeah, contact us through the Facebook page.
Are you writing a film at the minute, or are you working on a project? What's next?
Andy and I have got a couple of projects in the pipeline. They're not particularly down the survival horror kind of genre. We'd like to just take a little bit of a break from that and try something different. I'm working with Annie on a new project, which will be sort of 6 10-minute web episodes that we're going to stick on YouTube. That's horror based again. Yeah, we've got some stuff going on.
Yeah, we've got a couple of music parodies I think we might be looking at, and going back to something that we had a look at last year, which was a sort of like maybe a sitcom of some sort. Again, that would probably be sort of short web episodes. Of the
Do you need a DJ in any of yours? Because I'm alright with acting, I think. I can, like, you know, brush a broom, or I can, you know, whatever.
Yeah, we might, yeah.
What have you, you've got something for me to read. I'm just going to do it, because I think I'm alright with acting. I'll just go for it. So what is it? This is, where is this part of the, this line come from?
So one of my favourite films is Blade Runner. And at the end, there's a famous scene in it about tears in the rain. And initially, it was more close to this line, but I wanted to sort of get the same atmosphere that you do in that scene, in this scene, as kind of like a, I guess, again, a homage to that kind of film. But it's where Andy's kind of finishing off his diary entry before he then comes face to face with, you know, this unforeseen enemy. So it's meant to be said with, you know, passion and
I can do passion.
Thought. It's meant to be thoughtful. Yeah. Go give it.
I'll give it a go.
Yeah.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Because in this new world, there's few of us left to love, left to fight, left to survive.
It's not bad.
Not bad.
Like, if I was going to give a bit of direction, like what I did to Andy in the film. There's like certain pauses, like there, in order to hit mark to make sure that you get certain emphasis into certain words, so it doesn't always kind of merge into one. So it's all about like hitting a pause after there are a few of us left. Pause.
Right. Oh, I
left
see.
Left to love.
Right.
Pause.
Okay.
Left to fight, because you want to try and get the idea of fight across, and then left to survive is the tears in the rain.
Whatever danger you face, I wish you luck, because in this new world, there are a few of us left. Left to love, left to fight, left to survive.
I see a lot of you do multiple jobs in there. Was it hard putting so many hats on at so many times?
Yes, it was. Do you want to go first? How many roles did you have?
How many different roles in the film? As in, like, what characters was I playing?
Yeah.
Are we going to inform them of the scene that no one else knows about?
Yeah, that's right.
Where, because there's the scene actually where Hansi's actually walking up with his pistol, going into the truck.
Yeah.
There's three zombies that run towards from the car park. We have our executive producer Annalise, and there's another man. And then there's our friend Kane as well, who's there. The man who's in the blue hoodie is actually me doing a cameo, adding up as a zombie. So, but yeah, I mean, bar that, I think that was the only scene I had to play outside of the main character. But there were several zombies who, in particular, I think Sam Allen, he was on several sort of locations with us, wasn't he? Both in the field and then, you know, when we were filming over in Wokingham.
Yeah.
I think he was over in the precinct as well. So I think we did use some people we did use on several occasions. So
one thing I would not do again is put me in it. It's very difficult to be behind the camera as well as in front of it.
Right, it's your turn.
Yeah. Just trying to find someone to shoot it how you want to shoot it. When you're in front of it, it's very difficult. You obviously can't just, you know, hold the camera like a selfie and film yourself, so that doesn't work. So yeah, if I was to do it again, it definitely would not cast me in a role that.
I like the fact that a lot of it was filmed at night. Is that something you worked only on because of the camera effects, or was that just because that was what it was?
It's a massive mistake again, because the lens, the camera that I use, luckily lets a lot of light in, but because we didn't have a massive budget for the film, ideally you would shoot at night time, but you would light then the scene how you wanted it to be lit. But because we don't have a massive set, we don't have a massive lighting team, that it was just impossible to we had to get the atmosphere that it was dark and it was, you know, that kind of presence. But at the same time, we didn't have the proper lighting to light the scenes, so it was very, very difficult to do that. Some bits were just too dark, and that's what I would change again if I went back.
Was there any film, any scenes that you had to film over and over again because it just wasn't right?
Well, we did read that. I suppose the message that I was reading, or the letter that we did read that several times. We did do the scene where I'm speaking in regards to the line that you read earlier, we did read that several times as well. I'm not even sure. I don't think it was too bad. For me personally, I don't think there was any great repetition.
No.
I don't know if other people would feel the same way, but I'm not sure there was anything that was like done. There were times, I suppose, when we did something and we had to come back to it, maybe because it wasn't shot or wasn't how exactly we wanted it the first time. But actually, at the time, I don't think that we went through and did something again and again and again and again. It didn't feel that way, anyway.
It was only the key moments that we wanted to make sure that we absolutely nailed. It's like with that line, you know, we wanted to make sure that it was right. And again, it was very difficult to understand what we'd got without me going back to the studio and sitting down and listening to it and sticking the music over the top and then working out whether or not it works. So, and the going back was just like extra bits to make sure that we had enough filler and the timing was right.
I love the ambience of the music in between. Is it something you bought or you made yourself? Or
no, definitely not. So all the music is not is commercial music, so you'll find stuff that you might recognise from
the end scene. Was the when it all goes quiet and all of a sudden I don't know.
Yes, it's the song's called Bangarang by Skillerex, I think. Is it Skillerex?
Fine. Game on, boys.
Transformers in there, there's Halo 4 music I used a lot, there's the new Dread film, there's a lot of music from that in it. That's really where my passion for filmmaking comes from, and I feel like the music is so important in film these days, so all of my inspiration will come from me sat down listening to the music and then picturing what I want to happen at certain key points. And it's all about, like I said earlier on, about that shiver up your spine moment,
definitely.
Where music hits something that's visual, and when those two combine in a perfect way, you get that kind of that good feeling.
The camera was, I loved the bit when you were filming the bike and or was it the car, and the camera was outside the window.
Yeah, that was difficult. So I was travelling along the A329M at 10 o'clock at night filming the bike, hanging out the window, which isn't the safest thing. Don't do that at home, kids. Needs must. Yeah, you just sort of work around it.
It's been brilliant. Thank you very much for taking the time. So obviously you can see it on YouTube.
Yeah.
Is there a website you can also see it on, or is it just mainly on?
Yeah, so just YouTube or Facebook. The Facebook page is facebook.com/projectl2s. So if you go straight to there, you can like on there. That's also got the first film on there, which is worth watching. Like I said, posters and comps and stuff. So yeah, check it out there.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Cheers, guys.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
What a great interview. They made me feel so welcome. Andy Mason and Greg Rudman for the film Project Left to Survive. It's free to watch on YouTube. Take a look at it, because it's great. Now, before I go, I just want to let you know how you can email me on anything, absolutely anything. It's thegrumpygrandad@gmail.com, thegrumpygrandad@gmail.com. Now, next time round, I'm going to be interviewing the queen of drum and bass. Now, if I can pull this off, it's going to be another amazing interview. I can't believe it, because she's replied to my email. I honestly didn't think she would, but she has. I'm not going to mention her name, but if you're into your drum and bass and you know who I'm talking about, keep it stumped. Don't say anything, all right? Thank you for downloading this, and I will speak to you next time round. Good night, be good.
The Spiveycast is produced and edited by Paul Spivey. It's co-produced by Alex Buchter. The thoughts and comments in this podcast have nothing to do with Blunt Radio. The Spiveycast is part of the KSMG Media Group.
End of podcast.